hopefully we'll get you guys out in time for everybody to enjoy the evening night today. The sun's out.
Is it?
Yep.
We know.
It's
and here, it's before it came up this morning.
Pardon me?
Upload it on our...
Yes, it will be uploaded.
I just sent it to her like a couple hours ago, so.
Yeah.
All right. Sure, no problem. So, part two. This one, it's going to be a little bit shorter on each type because we don't focus as much here on these as we do on ovarian cancer, but just to kind of go through the different cancers that we treat. So we'll go through... uterine, actually not adnexal, we did that yesterday, cervical and vulvar cancer. So this is kind of a brief overview like we looked at yesterday. You know, uterine cancer is, you know, fairly common, but the others are pretty rare. And then the probability of developing cancer in females in general is just about 1 in 3, so it's obviously important for us to focus on. Cancer deaths, again, ovary is there right under pancreas, and then uterine cancer is right below that. So in terms of uterine cancer, we'll talk about general endometrial cancers and then uterine sarcomas. So endometrial cancer, we'll go through epidemiology, histology, how they present, how we diagnose them, staging, and then therapies. And then we'll kind of take a brief mention of, you know, future therapies and some perspectives on that. So for epidemiology, there are about, as I said, 60,000 cases were in 2016, and now it's even higher than that. Now it's up to about 11,000 deaths. So as you would expect, the localized, which is in the dark green, they do... most patients present early stage, which is different than ovarian cancer, which is nice, and a lot of that's because they have symptoms earlier. And they do pretty well. As you can see, localized disease, about 95% survival, and then when it spreads, about 68% five-year survival, and then obviously distant metastases do poorly. So increased risk factors include increasing age. Older women are more likely to develop it. Unopposed estrogens, either through exogenous sources, hormones that people are taking for various reasons, tamoxifen, and obesity. We know that estrogen is stored in fat cells, and there's peripheral conversion of hormone precursors as well. So people who are obese have higher endogenous estrogen activity. Genetic risks include Lynch syndrome and Cowden syndrome. And then decreasing things that are associated with decreased risk are progestational agents like oral contraceptives and a progesterone releasing IUD, the Mirena. Physical activity, pregnancy, and breastfeeding. So histology is the way we have typically classified them for the last probably 30 years or more. There's two types, type 1 and type 2. Type 1, they're generally an endometrioid histology. They're well differentiated. You can see they're kind of gland forming over on the right there. They tend to be less aggressive. They're usually more localized, and they generally have a better prognosis. Type 2s, the histologies associated with type 2 are clear cell, papillary serous, triple MTs, or carcinosarcoma, and they're poorly differentiated endometrial cancer. They tend to be more aggressive. They're more likely to have spread at initial presentation, and they have a worse prognosis. For their molecular features, type 1, they tend to be diploid. They generally have KRAS overexpression, P10 mutations, and microsatellite instability. Versus type 2, they tend to be aneuploid. They have KRAS overexpression as well, but they tend to have P53 overexpression. Clinical presentation. So usually patients present with abnormal uterine bleeding, and so that's why they're caught at an early stage. Whether it's just abnormal bleeding in people who are premenopausal, but most commonly people who are postmenopausal coming in with vaginal bleeding. So anyone who has vaginal bleeding after menopause, you know, that should, it's basically cancer until proven otherwise. They can have abnormal vaginal discharge. You can see it sometimes with endometrial cells on a pap smear, which you wouldn't expect, and sometimes atypical cells on a pap smear. And they may also have bloating, pelvic pressure, or pain if they have advanced disease, as you would with, like you do with ovarian cancer. For diagnosis, usually it's diagnosed on a combination of ultrasound, endometrial biopsy, or they can do a hysteroscopy with dilation and curettage. So on the ultrasound, they're looking for a thickened endometrial lining suggestive of hyperplasia or malignancy. We would then do an endometrial biopsy in the office. And if that doesn't show anything or we're not able to do that in the office, which is sometimes the case, then they'll do the hysteroscopy and do a dilation and curettage at the time of that surgery. And then usually, occasionally we'll see patients who have a diagnosis of endometrial cancer when they had a hysterectomy for other reasons, but usually the treatment is hysterectomy with or without the bilateral salpingo-oophorectomy, with or without lymph node sampling, depending on the situation. Stages, so bless you. So stage one is confined to the uterus. So stage one, it's confined basically to the, this is a little bit older, but, and 1A is basically within the inner one half of the uterus, and 1B is something that extends to more than half of the width of the uterine muscle. Stage two, it's grown into the cervix. So it was here, but it's kind of invaded down to the cervix. Stage three, it's spread either, you know, into the vagina or into the lymph nodes. Also, can be seen if it's higher up that it's spread to other pelvic structures, but has not spread beyond that. And then stage four is either distant metastases like liver metastases, any intra-abdominal, like higher up above the pelvic rim, or it's invading into the bladder or the bowel, like all the way through. So therapy for early disease, generally people who are early get surgery. If they have less than 50% myometrial invasion or stage one, and they don't have any adverse risk factors, then basically you've cured them just with surgery. And then if they're low grade. If they're grade two, you can either observe them or give them vaginal brachytherapy, which is radiation that's administered locally. And then for grade three, in some cases you'll observe, but most commonly you'll give them vaginal brachytherapy. If they have adverse risk factors present, then most of the time we give them vaginal brachy plus minus external beam radiation therapy to the pelvis. That comes with higher risk of, you know, morbidity and, you know, bowel obstructions and other problems. So we only do it if they have, you know, risk factors that would make us concerned for their risk of recurrence. If they're stage 1B and greater than 50% myometrial invasion, so again, some people who don't have risk factors, they'll observe or do vaginal brachytherapy. And basically, it's the same. You know, a lot of these things are, you know, depend on the risk factors. So things that we look at are, do they have cancer cells invading, like the lymph node, the lymphovascular invasion, and, you know, do they have it, you know, cells that are trying to kind of sneak out? Is the, you know, grade high, things like that. But a lot of these things, there's no, like, exact answer, and a lot of these things we continue to debate, like, every tumor board. For locally advanced disease, so not distant, but it's spread beyond the uterus, So for stage two, they definitely get brachytherapy, and they may get external beam as well. And then for people with high grade, they may also get chemotherapy. For those who have a stage 3A, they get, after surgical staging, they generally will get both chemo and radiation therapy. And exactly what kind and how much they get with radiation and if they get some after radiation and all these things are still kind of being worked out in clinical trials. And then for patients that have stage above stage 3A, so 3B, 3C, and stage 4, they basically get chemotherapy and generally also tumor-directed radiation therapy. So if they have a recurrence, and, you know, for early stage disease, fortunately that's, you know, not as common as it is like for ovarian cancer, then they'll get either re-excision, so they'll have surgery again to take out the cancer recurrence if it's kind of localized to one place. They may get radiation directed towards the site of the recurrence, or they can be treated with systemic therapy, such as either hormonal therapy that includes, like, generally like Megase, sometimes alternating with tamoxifen. They found that you know, these are hormonally sensitive tumors, so if we treat them with Megase, which is progesterone, it basically inhibits the growth of the tumor cells in many of the tumors. But tumors are smart, so they then downregulate their progesterone receptors. So we found that if you alternate it with tamoxifen, that it helps maintain the progesterone receptors and their sensitivity to that therapy. But more commonly, we use chemotherapy if the patient is, you know, well and not really elderly and frail. And like most things in GYN oncology, we treat with carboplatin and Taxol. There are some other things that work as well, but most of the time we treat them with carbotaxol or some of these other options. For follow-up, basically they get regular pelvic exams, making sure that the patient is aware of what the symptoms of recurrence are, like spotting, abnormal discharge, pain, bloating, things like that. As opposed to what we did in the past, there's no role for routine imaging or vaginal cytology. So most people think when you have your uterus and cervix out, you don't need to do a pap anymore. They thought that in these cancer patients, even though they had everything out, sometimes you can detect a vaginal recurrence through doing pap smears of the vaginal cuff, but that's actually not true. You don't detect it any sooner. For emerging therapies, things that we're looking into are things such as sentinel node mapping. That's instead of doing a full lymphadenectomy, which can lead to a lot of morbidity and lymphedema and infections and problems, just doing the sentinel node on each side, and that's something that's like actively being investigated in many centers do it, including ours. We're just adopting it now. Other things that we are looking into is fertility preservation. So because the obesity epidemic is affecting the increased rate of uterine cancers, there are many patients who are much younger than we used to find having endometrial cancer. So they may be in their 40s or even their 30s and want to have children, or they had one child but want another. We're finding ways to not have to do a hysterectomy or at least delay, and a lot of that is by using these progesterone IUDs and just surveillance. And then when they're completed with their childbearing, then they'll go on to have a hysterectomy. And then also targeted therapies as most other things. So as opposed to the type 1 and type 2 that we've used for years and years and years, this paper was came out in 2013. This was an analysis of the TCGA database looking at the molecular profile of endometrial cancers, and these were, most of them were endometrioid of various grades. Some were serous and then some mixed types. And they basically found four general categories of endometrial cancers. So the ones with the best prognosis generally are the POLE-E or ultra-mutated phenotype. The second group is the MSI, hypermutated type, so like your Lynch syndrome patients, things like that. And then your copy number low, these are generally endometrioid patients, and then copy number high, which are serous-like. And you can see that for each of these categories, you can see what different mutations or amplifications are generally present. And then a lot of them has, you know, the tumor grading correlated here. So these tend to be high grade. These are definitely high grade. These tend to be low grade because they're endometrioid. Makes sense. And then you can see here that it correlates with their overall survival. So the serous-like have the worst prognosis. The poly have the best prognosis. And then here are the proportion of tumors from each category that have mutations in each of these groups. So, I mean, serous tends to have P53, the POLE, and the MSI tend to have P10, and so on and so on. So we're getting better and better at profiling these tumors, not just by what they look like under the microscope, but by what their actual mutations are and or amplifications. It helps us know how they're going to do and how we might treat them better. This is also done for carcinosarcoma, and that's a really nasty version of endometrial cancer that you don't see as much. And what I found interesting here is that they're starting to take a look at not just, you know, what mutations they have and how frequent they are, but how they help affect your sensitivity to different targeted therapies and chemotherapies. So this is sensitivity to PI3 kinase inhibitors, which are in many clinical trials, CDK inhibitors, mTOR inhibitors, which are definitely being trialed in endometrial cancer as well as many others, anti-HER2 therapies, and so on and so on. So, so overall, this is hopefully going to lead to potential changes in our practice through these molecular categorizations. So this is from a paper from 2016, I think, looking at how some of the immediate changes that we can start making and how we treat patients with these different categories of endometrial cancer, and then what some of the future studies are. So obviously for the POLE and the MMRD tumors, you're going to definitely be thinking about immunotherapy options for those. And then in the P53 wild type, you know, we're finding that they have a lower likelihood of having metastatic disease, so they may be able to be managed by more in the community, not necessarily having to come to, you know, a level 3 center, potentially more susceptible to hormonal management or fertility sparing in those patients. And those with P53 mutations, you're going to be much more strongly recommending against fertility sparing treatments, much more aggressive clinical staging, things like that. And then there's uterine sarcoma. These are really nasty. Fortunately, they're much more rare. The median age tends to be in the 40s and 50s. Based on their, depends on the histologic type. Leiomyosarcomas are more common in black women than in white women, and the age-adjusted risk is 1.5 versus 0.9 per 100,000 women. Risk factors include prior radiation exposure, so, you know, people who may have had, like, colon cancer may present, you know, a couple years later with endometrial sarcoma, things like that. Hormone exposure, endometrial stromal sarcoma is the only true contraindication to hormone replacement after surgery for a GYN malignancy. And then tamoxifen use can predispose you to certain types of endometrial cancer, generally like ESS and sarcomas, but we don't routinely screen people for tamoxifen, who are on tamoxifen, unless they have symptoms, because it's not been found to diagnose people any earlier. And then, again, hereditary predispositions like Lynch syndrome. So leiomyosarcomas are fleshy. They generally have nuclear atypia. They have tumor necrosis. Here. So this is the uterus kind of split in half. That's the cervix. And this is a big, nasty leiomyosarcoma there. You can see they're, you know, kind of, they look kind of muscular almost, as opposed to some of the epithelial tumors we've seen. This is probably just a little fibroid there. And then endometrial stromal sarcoma, they're low grade. They're kind of bland looking. It's usually a single mass, and they're ERPR positive. Histology, so there's undifferentiated uterine sarcoma. And these have very atypical cells. You can see this highly nuclear, kind of spindle-shaped, you know, very blue-looking, and it just grossly looks really nasty, very aggressive. Their presentation is similar. They have abnormal vaginal bleeding, hopefully, and in those cases they may get diagnosed sooner. But many women actually present with an abdominal pelvic mass, you know, kind of pelvic discomfort. They think, oh, I have fibroids, they're just growing, you know, and unfortunately in some of these cases it's actually a rapidly growing sarcoma. And then some, as I mentioned, are incidentally diagnosed at the time of hysterectomy. For diagnosis and staging, for leiomyosarcomas, stage one is limited to the uterus. Stage two, it extends into the pelvis. It can be either adnexal involvement or it extends to other pelvic tissues. Stage three invades abdominal tissues, not just protruding into the abdomen, but is actually metastasized there. And then stage four, it invades either the bladder, the rectum, or distant metastases. For endometrial stromal sarcoma, you know, it's a little bit different. You probably will never have to do that, but just so that you understand that there's a, you know, difference. Some of them, here we go. This kind of looks at like how many centimeters there are versus here. It does not, it's more like where is it limited to. It's entirely working, there we go. So there's a difference in the staging. For therapies, for endometrial stromal sarcoma, generally we just treat them with surgery and then observation. Sometimes we'll treat them with hormonal therapy. Sometimes we consider radiotherapy if we don't have many other options, but they generally aren't as responsive, so we generally treat them with surgery or hormonal therapy. For leiomyosarcoma, we do treat them with chemotherapy and radiation, but the overall effect on survival is pretty minimal. There have been a lot of negative clinical trials. A lot of them have disappointing results despite what we find in mouse models or, you know, in vitro. And the other challenge is that most trials have very few patients and slow accrual because they're just very rare tumors. These are the NCCN guidelines for uterine sarcoma. You can see there's a few different combinations, like Taxol and gemcitabine, doxorubicin, gemcitabine, dacarbazine, and vinorelbine, and then hormone therapy for a low-grade ESS or hormone receptor-positive leiomyosarcoma, and then there are a bunch of single-agent options, but generally, people generally don't do well once this tumor is spread. It doesn't respond to chemotherapy as well as, endometrioid does or like ovarian cancer does. For follow-up, recurrence is pretty common, so we bring them back pretty frequently. They have routine exams, and these patients do get routine CT scans, and then you know, just patient symptom monitoring and making them aware of what to look for. For emerging therapies, we continue to do different chemotherapy trials. We're definitely investigating biologic therapies even more aggressively in this group because there really is no really good treatment for it. Some of the ones that we're looking at, because these tumors tend to have a lot of genetic mutations, are anti-VEGF therapies, multi-tyrosine kinase inhibitors, and mTOR inhibitors. So, any questions about either of those guys. Cervical cancer. So we'll kind of go through epidemiology, histology, presentation, diagnosis, staging, therapies, follow-up, and our future therapies for cervical cancer. So for the epidemiology, there's about 12,000, 13,000 cases a year. Probably, it's a pretty steady, about 7.7 cases per 100,000 women, as opposed to the like 1 or 1.5 for leiomyosarcoma. About 4,000 deaths expected in 2016, and that's for the United States. You can see about half of patients present with localized disease, and the next, you know, most of the ones that are not localized have just regional. But there's, you know, a pretty significant drop off from 91-92% survival to 57% for survival for localized disease. So once it's spread, people don't do as well. And, you know, generally the U.S. is not where most of the global burden of disease is. It's in developing countries. This is looking at the age standardized incidence of cervical cancer worldwide. You can see, you know, South America, Sub-Saharan Africa, India, and Asia tend to have higher rates. So the epidemiology continues, you know, it's related to HPV infection, patients that have high parity, increased number of sexual partners, young age at the first sexual contact, low socioeconomic status, a history of smoking, long-term use of oral contraceptives, and physical inactivity. For histology, there's, you know, most of them are either squamous or an adenocarcinoma. Adenocarcinoma is comprised about 25% of cases, and most of the rest are squamous cell. There are some rare histologies, such as clear cell, serous, glassy cell, neuroendocrine tumors, and mesenchymal tumors, but those are very rare. For pathogenesis, so if you look at this being the normal, you know, this is the squamous surface, and then moving down into the stroma of the cervix with CIN1, or what we call low-grade mild dysplasia, you'll see with the HPV infection, you'll have viral production, and you start having these atypical-looking cells, you know, clearing with the viral infection. You'll see these, like, clear spaces. In moderate dysplasia, you'll see that the atypical cells are comprising a higher per, you know, basically instead of just a third or so of the epithelium, they're comprising closer to half of the epithelium. There's no longer so much virus production, but more atypical cells. In severe dysplasia, most of the epithelium is now comprised of these abnormal cells. And these you'll see, like if you did IHC staining, you would see high E6 and E7 viral staining. And then for carcinoma in situ or CIN3, you no longer see these different layers of the epithelium. It's all atypical cells, but that has not progressed through the basement membrane. And then in invasive carcinoma, you get invasive carcinoma. And these are kind of where the viral DNA has integrated. We'll talk about that in a second. So for HPV, you know, it's associated with more than 99% of cervical cancers. And basically, in a normal cell, you have P53 and the RB tumor suppressors. And after viral infection, basically they inhibit both of these tumor suppressors, leading to carcinogenesis. E6 basically degrades P53, and E7 inhibits RB and other things. So cervical cancers arise due to the viral inactivation of these tumor suppressors. P53 inactivation also leads to genomic instability, secondary genetic alterations, and intratumoral heterogeneity. MYC and RAS play a significant role in cervical cancer. Mutant RAS genes are capable of cooperating with HPV and transforming the cells. And overexpression of MYC has been demonstrated in one-third of early invasive carcinomas and even some just severe dysplasias, CIN3 lesions. And then CDK inhibitor P16 is almost always upregulated in most cervical dysplasias as well as cancers. So these are just some histology slides. So you can see this is the H&E and this is the P16 staining. So even in CIN1, in this example, you have P16 staining. It becomes even stronger in CIN3 and then adenocarcinoma is present as well as squamous cell carcinoma. And this is a higher power view. You can see there's basically none below the epithelium and here in the CIN3. Clinical presentation, people can have post-coital bleeding, abnormal uterine bleeding, an abnormal pap smear, pelvic pain, flank pain, and more advanced disease, as well as uncontrolled leakage of urine or stool from the vagina, which is a fistula, and that's very advanced disease. For diagnosis, it's generally diagnosed by pelvic exam or biopsy. Sometimes if it's pretty clear that they have a cervical cancer, we'll do a biopsy. If they have some cervical dysplasia or if they have a biopsy that's concerning, then we'll do a cone biopsy. And that's basically taking like a coin basically off of the end of the cervix with electrocautery, or we basically cut out a cone of the endocervical tissue to send it to pathology. We get a chest x-ray to make sure we don't see any pulmonary metastases. They get an IV pyelogram to look at the kidney and ureters. They get a cystoscopy to look in the bladder and a proctoscopy to look in the rectum. And so this is just taking a look at high-grade precursors and an invasive cancer. It can take up to 10 years to develop a cervical cancer from dysplasia. So basically, if you're getting routine exams and PAPs, like, you shouldn't get cervical cancer. There's rare exceptions, but it's the people who have either never had a PAP or who had one, but it was like 20 years ago when I had my last baby is something I hear a lot, and they're like 60 and they came in with a cervical cancer. So screening is important. We can actually prevent this. For the staging, this is clinically staged because most patients with cervical cancer live in undeveloped or the developing world where they don't have advanced imaging or things like that. They don't have a PET CT scanner on every corner in sub-Saharan Africa, obviously. And so PET CT is often used here but not available there. So 1A1 is basically microscopic. We diagnose it on biopsy, but you can't actually see anything, or at least not an exophytic mass. 1B is something that you can actually see with your eye. 1B1 is less than 4 centimeters in size. 1B2 is greater than 4 centimeters in size. You can see 2A, it's spreading beyond the cervix. This is either spreading into the vagina or to the outside the pelvic wall into the perimetrium, as we call it, the supporting tissues around the uterus and cervix. Stage 3, it's either extending down into the lower part of the vagina or it's all the way to the pelvic sidewalls. These are the pelvic bones here. And then stage 4, it's invading either into the bladder or into the rectum. For therapy, for stage 1A1, we either do a cone biopsy or sometimes a hysterectomy. For stage 1A2, we either do a modified, we usually do a modified radical hysterectomy. For stages 1B and 2A, you can either do a radical hysterectomy or pelvic radiation therapy with, usually with chemotherapy added to radiation therapy in stages 1B, 2, and 2A. And then you can also add radiation therapy to 1B1 and 2A1, depending on the risk factors. From stages 2B to 4A, generally it's advised to do pelvic radiation with chemotherapy and not do surgery. The reasons for that are that most of the time these patients will require radiation even after their surgery. We usually can't get all of it. The risk of having surgery and radiation therapy, their morbidity later on is pretty severe. So, and it's about the same rate, about 50% of cure using each of those modalities. And then stage four, definitely systemic chemotherapy and maybe clinical trials, but most of those patients are, it's going to be a palliative treatment. For follow-up, a lot of these patients require a lot of psychosocial support. It's a pretty devastating diagnosis when it's not localized, and they can have a lot of patients, if they end up with a lot of pain or fistulas, it's pretty devastating. They get routine pelvic exams to look for recurrent disease, and then cytology. Emerging therapies for this group, we're also investigating sentinel node mapping for those patients and fertility preservation. Sometimes we'll do for patients who are young, because, you know, I've seen it. I diagnosed somebody who was like 23 when I was a resident, and she ended up dying before I graduated. But in some patients with early stage disease, because they are young, you can do something called a trachelectomy, where you're basically chopping off the cervix and leaving the uterus there. And that way, they have a way to, potentially have childbearing capacity later on. And then targeted therapies and immunotherapies. So I know there's multiple ongoing trials looking at either TIL therapy, checkpoint inhibitors, things like that. And now we, one of the standards of care for recurrent cervical cancer is actually the use of bevacizumab. So, questions about cervical cancer? It's nasty. Don't get it. Everybody tell your friends to get the HPV vaccine. Alright. Vulvar cancer. Same stuff we're going to go through. So there's about 6,000 cases per year, and 1,000 deaths, or a little more than that. Most of them are localized disease, and similar to others, the earlier they are, the better they do. But as you can see, even the localized disease, they're only about 85% five-year relative survival. Some of this may be just because a lot of the patients who get this are really old. So, epidemiology. You can either be through having like condylomas, like with HPV infection, a history of squamous dysplasia, HPV infection in a basaloid or warty type. Common risk factors that are in common with cervical cancer are, having a high number of sex partners, an early age at the initiation of sexual contact, and a history of abnormal pap smears is also a risk factor for vulvar cancer. HPV is associated more commonly in women with vulvar cancer who have it under 50 years, but non-HPV related vulvar cancer is more common in older women. So this is what vulvar cancer looks like. So early disease, they basically have, a lot of people complain of persistent irritation or discoloration or bleeding or itching. A lot of women do get a delayed diagnosis because their provider isn't sure what it is, or they're ashamed to, get an exam or whatever it is. But it's kind of general stuff. And then late disease, there was a picture up here, but I didn't want to gross you out, so I took it off. They can have severe pain, bleeding, pressure from these really large and large from these really enlarged masses, foul odor just from necrotic tissue, and really they become very disfigured. Staging, I won't go through all of it, but stage one, it's very localized and it's very small. Stage two, it starts to invade further throughout the perineum. Stage three, it's spreading down past the rectum. Stage four is basically intra-abdominal metastases and pelvic lymph nodes. So in here, you can kind of see what the stages are here, but 1A is less than 2 centimeters, 1B is greater than 2 centimeters, and it basically spreads mostly by direct extension, although some do have lymphatic spread, so when they do surgeries, they sometimes have to do lymph node dissections too, which I'll show you in a minute. So for early stage disease, they do local excision. They basically just, you know, take it off, try and get like a good margin. But even some of the smaller lesions, it can be kind of disfiguring, and there's a lot of like psychosocial issues about sexuality that certainly come up for this type of cancer. For locally advanced disease, they get really massive surgery. So this is like where her vagina and uterus used to be. This is the Foley catheter. They get these huge excisions, and then this is the inguinal lymph node dissections that they did. And it used to be these like huge, massive surgeries. We've now found that doing smaller resections plus therapy is better, especially for the patients. You know, in terms of complications. And this is like a lymph node dissection. So instead of doing these like massive surgeries, we take out the lesion and then we go find the lymph nodes through smaller incisions. Therapy for metastatic disease, generally we use chemotherapy, but it's disappointing. They don't really respond very well. And so targeted therapies are under development. So again, are not very fun. For follow-up, psychosocial support, routine exams, any abnormal, you know, growths or itching, just like they had on their initial presentation. And so the risk can be reduced by modifying their risk factors, you know, stopping smoking, you know, being aware about, you know, sexual contact, things like that. Most cancers are responsive to frontline therapies, but management of recurrent disease, it depends on the site of origin and the histology, but it's usually not great, and it's life prolonging, but it's not going to be curative. And so we need more discoveries to overcome these diseases, which are horrible, horrible diseases, and you guys should discover the magical cure for cancer and fix them. So about it. There's a little bit less stuff in it, but any questions?
Okay.